Chapter 104. Sfecostina Air Base, Tunisia. After Chief Nick Zeppos announces the departure of the SEAL platoon they were depending on, the hot and smelly room falls silent, and Matt Keating seems to stiffen and grow a few inches. With his beard growth, the clothes he's wearing, and the look in his dark eyes, the man doesn't look like a former president of the United States to Nick. Nick sees a fellow SEAL operator. "Chief," Matt says, the word hard and sharp, "you promised us transportation. We don't have it. You going back out there to get it?"
"Yes, sir,"
Nick says. Matt says, "I don't care if you bribe a pilot, threaten a pilot, or hijack an aircraft, or rent one. And if there isn't a helicopter or a fixed-wing aircraft out there, get a truck or a 4x4, because one way or another, Nick, we're crossing into Libya tonight and going to the Nafusa Mountains. I'm not waiting on intelligence, and I'm not waiting on transport. We're going out tonight to get my daughter back."
"On it, sir,"
Nick says, and he quickly leaves the building. Outside, Nick walks to the small collection of aircraft at the end of the runway and starts running through options and possibilities. Transportation is a given, he knows, but what's the point without actionable intelligence? He knows that President Keating's friends in Mossad and the Saudi intelligence service are working hard to locate Asim al-Rashid, but Nick also knows from bitter experience that good intelligence comes organically. It can't be forced or hurried, because then you end up with crap intelligence that leads to a crap mission and casualties. The low roar of jet engines comes to him, and the New Hampshire Air National Guard KC-135 that brought them here takes off, heading to its original destination of Rota, Spain. And Nick feels a bit jealous of that crew. They're military. They have a job to do, and while it may be challenging, they never have to stretch rules and regs to get it done. Nick recalls a vital sentence of the SEAL creed. "We expect innovation." So innovate already, he thinks. As he gets closer to the assembly of aircraft, another, fainter engine noise reaches him, and he scans the clear Tunisian sky. Two Black Hawk helicopters are approaching from the south, looking to come in for a landing. They move nearly as one, and Nick admires their pilots' skills as one aircraft, and then the other, lands swiftly and carefully. Their fuselages are painted black, with a white roundel with a red crescent moon and a star. A handful of flight crew members run from the nearest hangar and approach the helicopters as their rotors slow down. And as the crews emerge, removing their flight helmets, Nick stops, amazed. He recognizes one of the pilots from his training visit last year. Talk about innovation. He resumes walking as the tall pilot with the thick black mustache sets off, joking and smiling with his co-pilot and two aircrew members. Nick yells out, "Joe! Is that you, Joe?" The man he calls Joe stops, looks over, and grins as Nick gets closer.
"Chief Zeppos?" he asks. "What the hell are you doing out here?"
His English has traces of both Arabic and French accents. Nick extends a hand, which is promptly shaken by Youssef Zebidi, also known to the SEAL trainers as Joe, a captain in the Tunisian Army's Groupe des Forces Spéciales. Joe's free hand holds a leather dispatch case and his flight helmet. He's wearing a dark green flight suit, his name on his name patch in Arabic script. Epaulets on each shoulder display his rank. 3 stars. Nick says, "I'm on a job."
"Really?" the captain asks. "That's a surprise. I surely would have been briefed that you were coming here. You're not here to join up the SEAL platoon that's been here for 3 weeks, are you? I'm afraid they're far away from here, assisting a unit of French Paras to the south."
"No," Nick says. "It's something else. Highly classified. Off the books. Joe, I really need your help."
"Is it important?" he asks.
"Very," Nick says, thinking, "We got this. It's gonna work out. We got this." But in just a second, Captain Zabidi's mood changes. His eyebrows narrow. Face darkens.
"When we last met, Chief Nick, you told me that my flying skills, as you say, suck. You said I belonged at one of your kiddie rides at an American amusement park. You said not only did I fly like a swine walking on ice, You said I fly like a drunken swine, walking on ice. Nick thinks, oh, shit. And Captain Zamidi spits on the pavement between them. Why in the hell should I help you with anything? He says.
Chapter 105. Svekostina Air Base, Tunisia. With Nick out seeking transportation, I put that problem away and get back to work. In the teams, you quickly learn that you have to depend on your teammates to get their job done while you concentrate on your own part of the mission. Nick is in charge of transporting us to Libya. I have to focus on the job at hand, getting my gear ready. From my two duffel bags, I pull out my disassembled Colt M4 automatic rifle and begin putting it back together, starting with inserting the bolt into the receiver. Other parts and components follow, and it's almost comforting as my muscle memory takes over, letting me put this weapon back together. I can do it in the rain, in a jungle, in pure darkness, and the satisfying clicks and snaps seem to calm me down. Alejandro Lopez and David Stahl are engaged in similar activities, and Claire Boone, quicker than the rest of us, has her own M4 assembled, and she's working her primary weapon, her NSA-issued laptop, wireless earbuds in both ears. After pairing up and connecting the upper receiver of the M4 to the lower receiver, I test it by pulling back the bolt and squeezing the trigger. Click. Time to prepare the ammunition. I break open boxes of 5.56mm ammo and start loading up the 30-round magazines, forcing each round into the spring-loaded metal magazine. I decide to have one magazine in the Colt M4 and six in pouches. Next up is my Sig Sauer 9mm P226 pistol, and I'm going in with one 20-round magazine in the pistol and four more in other pouches. "Matt," Claire says, from the other side of the hot and smelly room. "Yeah," I say, trying to find the pouches for the pistol ammunition inside my duffel bag. "Give me a sec." Claire raises her voice. "You don't have a sec. Get your butt over here." I lift up my head. "What?" Claire pulls the earbuds out and says, "CNN International says Asim Al-Rashid is about to release another video, this time live." I drop what I have in my hands and quickly go over to Claire. She says, "And it's going to have Mel on it." I'm behind the sitting Claire, and Alejandro's on my left, David on my right. Claire taps on the keyboard, and the female news anchor from CNN International in London says, "Breaking news now, CNN has learned that in just a few moments, a live presentation is being made by terrorist mastermind Asim Al-Rashid to the Al Jazeera network, and..." "Hold on." The anchor looks away, and then the following words nearly make me gasp with relief, as she returns to looking directly at the camera and says, "It now appears that the president's daughter, Mel Keating, is in fact alive and well, and that the execution video from a few weeks back was a fake, and here is the broadcast." My hands are on the back of the chair that Claire is sitting in, and my fingers clench the metal as a picture comes into focus. My daughter, Mel Keating, face tired, smeared with dirt, wearing her eyeglasses, a black robe around her head and shoulders, some of her frizzy hair sticking out. The live video is grainy, not as crisp as the first one I saw back at the Saunders Hotel in Virginia. She's holding a newspaper in her dirt-covered hands, and the paper is slightly shaking in her trembling grasp. "Oh," is all I can say. But inside I'm yelling to myself, "She's alive. She's alive. No more hoping. There she is. She's alive." The calm and happy voice of Asim Al-Rashid becomes audible as he narrates the live video. "Ah, good day, Matt Keating," he says. "And as you can see, I have very good news for you. Mel Keating is alive and well." Claire says, "Matt," she's holding a copy of today's Daily News Egypt, an English language paper out of Cairo. Asim laughs for a sick second. "So, I fooled you, did I not? Like the West has constantly fooled my people over the years, from the Sykes-Picot Agreement during your First World War, that carved up lands not belonging to you among the British and French, to the Balfour Declaration that allowed the Zionists to invade and expel the Arabs, up to and including your so-called War on Terror, and invasions based on fantasies of weapons of mass destruction." I'm hearing Asim's words, but I'm still staring at Mel, seeing her look out at the camera, looking like she's fighting to keep calm. The newspaper continues to tremble in her hands. Asim says, "So I lied to you. I made you and your wife live in mourning for a few weeks, to give you just the slightest taste of what I have been feeling since you, Matt Keating, killed my wife and daughters. Now my lies are over. Now is the time for truth, to tell you what will happen next." He pauses and then says slowly and with firm clarity, "You took away my family, and as the law permits, I am due compensation, and that compensation, Matt Keating, is that your daughter is now mine." David whispers, "What the hell?" Asim says, "Your daughter is now my daughter, to repay me for what you did to my family. Soon she will receive a new name and will join me for the rest of her life as I raise her as my own. And you must consider this. Are you now in such a hurry to find me? To kill me? To drop one of your bombs or rockets on me? Think that through, Matt Keating. Because if you do that, the collateral damage, which you so often like to use as an excuse, will be your teenage daughter. Leave me alone. Let me live. For in doing so, you will let your daughter live. Masalama, Matt Keating." The sound cuts off, and I see my daughter for just a few more seconds before the screen goes blank. Alejandro whispers, "Fuck." And that one word explains everything. The bastard has put me into a tight corner. A very tight corner. With Mel no longer his captive, but his so-called daughter, Asim will have her close by his side for now, for tomorrow, and for years to come, daring me to rescue her and attack him and put Mel in immediate danger. Damn the bastard. The phone starts ringing and I yell, "Will somebody answer that damn thing? I'm trying to think over here." David says, "Matt, it's your phone." I go back to where my duffel bags and gear are located, pick up my burner phone. "Blocked caller," says the ID screen. And I answer it by saying, "Yes." "Matt," says an excited voice. "Yes," I say, recognizing Danny Cohen from Assad. "Danny, what's going on?" With joy in his voice, Danny says, "We found her. We know where Mel is located. No doubt about it."
Chapter 106. The Fusa Mountains, Libya. Jiang Li Jun of the Chinese Ministry of State Security is in a small room with stone walls and ceiling, sitting in a wooden chair, ankles and wrists chained to it. There's a locked wooden door about 2 meters away, and on either side of the door, small square windows in stone open outside, blocked by metal bars. The floor is dirt. He sits quietly, calmly, not knowing if there's a surveillance camera somewhere keeping tabs on him. He won't give anyone out there the pleasure of seeing him rattling or testing his chains. To keep his mind off what will no doubt be his last hours alive, he recalls the history of Admiral Zheng He, who more than 600 years ago set out with huge fleets of explorers and traders aboard ships that would overwhelm the European ships of the time. In his journeys, he became among the first Chinese to land on and explore Africa. Not this part of Africa, of course, but if the rulers back then had followed up on Admiral Zheng's journeys, the 15th century equivalent of the current Belt and Road Initiative? Oh, how history would have changed. The door is unlocked, opened, and Asim al-Ashid strides in, smiling. Standing outside are two of Asim's armed men, who are staring at him as if they have never before seen a man from China. "Li Jun," Asim says, "I admire your dedication and persistence to come all this way, through so many hardships, to talk to me." Jiang says, "It's my job." "Oh? And was it your job to bring along a squad of assassins to attack me and my followers?" Jiang says carefully, "You know how dangerous these lands are. I was only being cautious with what resources were available to me. No plan to attack you was even considered. Asim smiles. I am sure. He turns, barks out an order, and a metal folding chair is brought in. He sits down. Well, here you are. The last time we spoke, back in America, you said you admired what I had done and that you were prepared to offer me assistance. Does that offer still stand? Do you still wish to assist?
Circumstances have changed, Jiang says. And so has my offer to you.
I see, Asim says. Anything else?
Jiang says, the fact that I am here is clear truth that you can be discovered. If the Americans believe Mel Keating is alive,
they do know. Asim interrupts. I just broadcasted a live video demonstrating she is alive. And thank you for your warning. I do not plan to stay here in these mountains much longer. Do go on.
Jiang says, knowing she is alive, the Americans won't stop looking for her and trying to kill you. Turn her over to me, and I will return her to American custody. My government will offer you a generous reward. Fulfill any desire or need you have. Just return the girl to me.
Asim seems to be pondering this, but Jiang isn't fooled. There's a mocking look in those dark brown eyes.
Ah, yes, you and your mercantile country, always willing to trade, to deal, to make profits, Asim says. I'm sure that's what you mean by reward, correct? Lavish sums of money. Safe relocation to another country. A life of leisure, comfort, and wealth. Only if I release that teen girl to you.
Asim quickly stands up, grabs the chair. But there are people in this world, my friend, who have no need for wealth or luxury, who answer only to God. Later this day, I will show you what I mean, in greater detail. And then you will be safely released to return home, to tell your masters that you have finally met a man who couldn't be wooed or bribed against his beliefs.
Asim leaves. The door closes behind him, and the lock is re-engaged. Jiang sighs. Alive for now, but he doubts Asim is telling the truth. Why should Asim release him? He's alone. But he doesn't remain alone for long. Just a few minutes later, the door is unlocked and opened again. And this time, it's Asim's cousin, Faraj, who comes in. In his right hand is a khaki-colored square satchel that he sets on the dirt floor. He closes the door behind him and says,
You made an offer to my cousin.
Repeat it to me. Mel Keating is released safely in my custody, and you will be amply rewarded.
Specifics, Faraj says. Give me specifics.
Jiang says, 20 million euros in any confidential numbered bank account you may have or that we can set up. Safe transportation to any place in the world, and free lodging. New identification so the American, British, and Israeli services never find you.
Faraj nods. Is that deal for Asim? Or anyone else?
Jiang is pleasantly stunned. Anyone who will release Mel Keating to me and give us safe transport out of Tripoli.
Then I will do it, Faraj says. Not my cousin. I am tired of jihad, of rotten food, of sleeping in caves, always fearing a drone will fire a missile at me. You and I, we will make this deal.
Fascinating. But Jiang is not sure if he's being set up for something. Could these two cousins, who have spilt so much blood between them, actually be having a falling out? Or is something else being planned? Is Faraj setting a trap for him? Time for caution.
Jiang says, I'm not sure I can trust you, and I'm not sure if I feel right in betraying Asim.
Faraj crosses the dirt floor, squats so he is eye level with Jiang.
You will cooperate with me. You will pay me. Or I will tell Asim that you were the one who murdered his family 3 years ago,
Faraj says. And not the Americans.
Jiang is frozen in place, not able to say a word.
How do you feel now? Faraj asks.
Chapter 107. Sfekostina Air Base, Tunisia. To the former head of Mossad, I said, Danny, please tell me more. What do you have? That video of Mel, it was a live feed, he says, his voice triumphant. It wasn't a recording. Our unit 8200 was able to decrypt the feed when it started and found where it was being transmitted to a Nassim sympathizer in Qatar, who was able to pass it along to another sympathizer with connections to Al Jazeera. But Matt, better yet, we were able to pinpoint where the transmission was coming from. The Israeli Unit 8200, their equivalent of our National Security Agency, professionals in every manner when it comes to signal intelligence, codes, and decryption. After I was sworn in as president and brought up to speed on the globe's various problems and hotspot areas, I was told that Unit 8200 was just as good as the NSA, and in some areas better. Danny, where did the transmission come from? In Libya, the Nafusa Mountains, he says. Coordinates to follow. Matt, 31 degrees, 54 minutes, 36.78 seconds north, and 11 degrees, 19 minutes, 3.66 seconds east. I found a pen, scribbled the vital numbers on the palm of my hand. Reading back, Danny, coordinates 31 degrees, 54 minutes, 36.78 seconds north, and 11 degrees, 19 minutes, 3.66 seconds east. Danny says, perfect. That's where she is, Matt. God bless. I disconnect the call to find that Chief Nick Zeppos and another man have come into the small maintenance hangar. Matt, Nick says, this is Captain Youssef Sabidi, a Black Hawk pilot with the Tunisian Army's Groupe des Forces Spéciales, their special forces. I had the honor of working with Captain Sabidi last year in a training assignment. I take a quick moment to write the coordinates on a slip of paper and pass it over to Claire Boone, and then I go to Nick and nod in his direction. Captain Sabidi, I say. The pilot is wearing a flight suit and is muscular, dark-skinned, with a thick mustache, and his face slowly goes from skepticism to slight awe. Nick says, I talked to Joe, that was our nickname for him back then, and told him what we were up to. Naturally, he didn't believe me, but I convinced him to at least come over here and see for himself. Right then, I see an abrasion under Nick's left eye and notice that the Tunisian army pilot's right cheek seems swollen. Some convincing. Captain Sabidi, I say, then you know what we're up to. Can you help? Sabidi nods and says, only for one thing. Do this thing, and it'll be fine. The tired, overworked, and mercenary part of me wonders what the pilot is looking for. Money, citizenship, gold bullion. And I give him the only answer I can. Absolutely, I say. What is it? He steps forward, slightly smiles, and extends his right hand. For the honor of shaking the American president's hand. I give his hand a quick shake. He grins at both me and Nick and says, for you, sir, and to rescue your daughter, my aircraft and crew are yours. A few minutes ago, I was so dog-tired and depressed, it felt like my butt was about to start dragging on the ground, but no more. I'm quickened, energized. And then Claire says, got it. Got it right here. I'm walking over to Claire when my phone starts ringing again. I'm tempted to ignore it, but since so few people know this burner phone's number, I answer it. Keating, I say. Another familiar voice comes on the line. Matt, are you well? Can you speak? It's Ahmad bin Nayef, former deputy director of the General Intelligence Directorate of Saudi Arabia. I say, Ahmad, of course, what is it? Then it feels like Christmas in June, for he says, we have her location. We know where Mel is. I'm almost giddy with relief. Just a few minutes ago, I had no idea where my girl is being held, and now I have two of the finest intelligence services in the Middle East coming through for me at the very last moment. Two sources, confirming where she is. Intelligence doesn't get any better than that. Is it the Nafusa Mountains in Libya? It is, he says. There is a courier who brings special supplies for Asim's cousin Faraj. Contractors working for us found him just as he was leaving Asim's compound. He was interrogated and came up with the location. He says the word in the camp is that a very important prisoner is there, a young girl, the daughter of the former American president, Matt. I am so pleased for you. Ahmad, thank you, So much, I say, my throat thickening. Samantha and I are eternally in your debt. Do you require any other assistance? He asks. I might be able to get a force of men for you within the next 24 hours. I say, we don't have the time, Ahmad, but thank you. We're heading out tonight. Then adhab ma'alaf, friend, he says. Here are the coordinates where she's being kept. 25 or so fighters are also there, so be careful. Ahmad slowly and efficiently gives me the coordinates, and I write them down on a slip of paper, and something is seriously not right. Ahmad, can you repeat that? Certainly. He does that, and I write down the coordinates once more. Phone still in hand, I go to Claire and hand her the slip of paper. Claire, Saudi intelligence is saying these are the coordinates where Mel is being kept. Key them in, will you? Certainly, she says, and she works the keyboard. By now, we, including the Tunisian pilot, are standing in a quiet semicircle behind her. On her laptop screen is a topographical map of the rough and rugged Nafusa Mountains. With her keyboard input, a blinking red triangle appears. I'm not an expert on computer mapping by any means, but I also see that there's an earlier blinking red triangle. Claire, I say. She swivels around in her chair, looks up at me. I'm sorry, Matt, she says. The coordinates don't match. The Israelis say she's in one place, the Saudis in another, about 20 clicks apart.
Chapter 108. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Jiang Lijun remains seated and quiet, not daring to say a word, or to move, or to otherwise do anything that will attract Faraj's attention even more. But Asim's cousin stands up and says,
Let's make progress, shall we? Let's stipulate you've just spent 10 or so minutes denying everything I've said. Very well. Now it's my time to speak.
Faraj goes to the satchel he brought in and starts unzipping the top.
3 years ago, Asim's family were killed when the American SEALs attacked the small village where they were living. I'm sure you recall this, especially since you were serving at your embassy here when the raid occurred.
He halts in opening the satchel and says,
Horrible, wasn't it? A woman and her 3 children, innocents all, killed in an explosion. Worldwide news with Matt Keating going on television later to apologize for this botched military operation.
He pauses.
But suppose it wasn't the Americans who did it?
Jiang finally says, I don't know what you're talking about. Faraj laughs.
Oh, don't insult me, dear Lijun. Let me finish, and then you can insult me. After the raid was over, and the bodies buried, I was bothered by the news. I talked to survivors who were there the night of the attack. They all agreed as to what happened. The Americans arrived, fighting began, but before they reached the house where Asim's family was residing, it exploded.
Jiang says, A hellfire missile, I'm sure.
Oh, no, not sure, Faraj says. Why would the Americans use a hellfire missile with so many of their soldiers nearby? Unnecessarily exposing them to danger? And when I went later to investigate with a good friend of mine, a man we called the engineer, well, the first thing we learned was that the explosion came from inside the building, not outside.
Easy to see if you are standing there. Jiang remains quiet. Sweat is starting to trickle down the back of his neck. Faraj opens the top of the satchel.
The engineer, he is an expert student in all things electronics and explosives, and graduated with honors from the American University of Beirut.
Ironic, eh?
But he told me that we were fortunate that the explosion took place inside the building because important clues and components would still be there. And he was right.
Jiang is fearfully focused on the satchel Faraj has brought in. What could be in there? A blowtorch? Pruning shears? Sharp knives? Faraj says,
You should have seen him at work. Very methodical, very slow, but after 2 days of searching, he found it. An electronic triggering device was inside a shipment of 82mm mortar rounds that were temporarily being stored there. Mortar rounds that were shipped to Asim from you. And the device would be triggered by a cell phone call.
Faraj reaches into the satchel, pulls out one, and then two cans. Jiang's eyes widen as he sees the familiar blue and white logo of a mountain climber ascending a peak, and the Chinese characters written on the side. Snow beer. Jiang says, "How?" Faraj deftly opens one can, brings it over to Jiang, and with Faraj holding the can to his lips, Jiang takes a deep, refreshing swallow of the cold beverage. Faraj steps back, opens the second can, and takes a long drink as well. Faraj says,
"My cousin knows nothing but Allah, jihad, and revenge. I, on the other hand, appreciate the technologies that the West has offered us. Like this."
He gently nudges the satchel with his foot.
"A battery-powered cooler. Ingenious, eh? Like that explosive device you attached to those mortar rounds."
Jiang says, "Thank you for the beer. It's quite refreshing." Faraj laughs.
"My, nothing seems to bother you.
No wonder you make such a good intelligence man.
You would probably continue to deny everything, even if I was sawing your bolts off.
But it makes sense. It all makes sense. Asim was an asset of yours for many years. But there always comes a time when an asset becomes a burden, an embarrassment. He must be retired. And somehow, that night 3 years ago, you learned the Americans were going to attack Asim. And the thought came to you, my intelligent friend, that a single phone call from you could retire your asset and also kill or humiliate the Americans. What they say, a win-win."
Jiang says, "You tell a good story, Faraj." Faraj approaches and offers the can of beer one more time. Jiang thinks of the drinking games he endured back when he was at Columbia, and he swallows. The can finished, Faraj steps back and says,
"But Asim lived. His family died. And your actions probably caused the election defeat of Matt Keating. All in all, a good trade-off, am I right? But here is tonight's trade-off. Later, there will be an opportunity for me to kill Asim. When that is finished, you will make the arrangements for my pay, new identity, and new home. Then you will get the girl."
Jiang says, "It will take some time to do that." Faraj finishes his own beer.
"I have all the time in the world. But just remember, you don't."
"What?" Faraj places the two empty cans in the cooler, zips it shut, and stands up.
"You betray me in any way, and Asim's other relatives and friends will be told of what you did. And you will not leave out the weak."
Chapter 109. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Mel Keating is sitting on the dirt and stone floor of her cell, knees drawn up, arms across her lower legs. She's thinking and observing, and damn it, she doesn't like what she's seeing. Or not seeing. The stone room has a light bulb hanging from a black cord run through a drilled hole in the doorframe. A wooden shelf with water bottles and various crackers and fruit snacks, and that's it. No latrine. And more importantly, no bed. Which means Asim doesn't plan on keeping her here for any lengthy amount of time. But he has said that she will be his forever. Lots of ways to interpret that. None of them good. Mel struggles to get up because her damn ankle is still throbbing something fierce. Tears come to her eyes, and it's not just the pain. Trapped. Oh my God, she is so trapped. Once she's on her feet, she goes to the shelf, drinks some water, eats some dry crackers, and then some fruit snacks. One snack appears to be made of some kind of cherry slop, and she gets red juice all over her fingers. Interesting. She keeps the juice on her fingers and plays with it for a while, and then licks them clean and takes another swig of water. Mel takes a deep breath, tries to ease the shakes in her arms and legs, because she knows no one's coming for her. Mom and Dad think she's dead. Asim is a murderous terrorist, but he's right about something. She's on her own. Time to get out of here. But how? She walks around the small interior, fingers on the bare rock, looking and evaluating, and it's bare rock. Only way in and out is through that heavily locked door. Sure, she thinks. I'll break through the door and overwhelm the armed guards outside, and then limp my way to freedom. She kicks at the door with her good foot, and then starts hammering away with her fists, yelling, "Hey, hey, hey!" Mel steps back. Great. Now both feet are aching. Wait. Hold on. The door is being unlocked. It swings into the cell, and there are two armed men there, peering at her, both maybe 19 or 20. Thin beards, white pants, brown vests over dark blue shirts. The one who's closer has an AK-47 hanging from his shoulder by a strap, and his companion standing a few yards back has his AK-47 pointing straight at her. Beyond them is a corridor leading to the main door outside. The corridor is flanked with old stone stables, filled with rations, bottles of water, boxes of ammunition and weapons. "Yes?" the first man asks. Thinking quickly, Mel says, "You know who I am, right? The daughter of the former president. Whatever you're getting paid here, he'll pay a lot more. A hell of a lot more to free me." The first man turns to the second one, laughs, and back to her, says, "Yes?" "Right. Right," Mel says. "My dad will make sure you two can come to America with your families. Start a new life. Safe and secure. And I'll pay whatever you want, I promise you. Just get me out of here." "Yes, yes," he says. And Mel thinks, "Really? Will it be this easy?" He steps forward, unshoulders his weapon, prods at her with the muzzle end of the AK-47, and, laughing again, steps back through the door, draws it closed, and locks it. "No," she thinks, turning away, her eyes brimming with tears. "It won't be this easy." Again, she looks around the room. No bathroom or sleeping arrangements. With a cold feeling in her gut, Mel knows that forever is coming very soon for her.
Chapter 110. Sfekostina Air Base, Tunisia. Back on the phone, I say, "Ahmad, something's not right. Are you sure on these coordinates?" "Positive, Matt," he says. "I was there during the interrogation, and we verified it with the courier by going over the satellite maps and other resources. Those are the coordinates." "But did he see Mel?" Ahmad says, "No, just heard the stories in the camp about a very important young girl being kept there, the daughter of the president. Matt, what is wrong?" I rub at my forehead and continue staring at Claire's computer screen and those two damnable blinking icons, so far apart. "What's wrong is that Mossad is telling me she is being held at another place in the Nafusa Mountains about 20 kilometers away," I say. "The video that Asim al-Rashid sent out earlier was a live feed. The Israelis were able to track down where the broadcast originated. It's not the same location that your source told you." Ahmad sighs. "The constant struggle, correct? Human intelligence versus signal intelligence. Can you talk to the courier again just to make sure?" A second of hesitation. "I am afraid I cannot do that, Matt. The courier is no longer available." In that one sentence, Ahmad just told me the courier is dead. Either died under questioning or was shot while trying to escape, or because a rival of Ahmad's and a supporter of Asim's spirited him away and then killed him to prevent him from talking anymore. "I understand," I say. "Is there anything else you can tell me?" "No, I cannot, Matt," Ahmad says. "My apologies. The call is disconnected." The room is quiet, everyone looking at me, in the middle of making the proverbial life or death decision. Despite the self-serving stories from presidential aides or what happens in popular movies, there aren't that many presidential decisions that are truly life or death. In fact, most presidential decisions are already made by the time an order or memorandum comes to one's desk. Decisions are made in work sessions, cabinet meetings, briefings up on Capitol Hill, and when they get to the Oval Office, it's almost perfunctory. But not now. The two blinking icons seem to mock me. Sir, Nick starts, and then stops. I know what he's thinking, what everyone else is thinking. We don't have the assets to make two missions tonight. Just the one. But which one? Ahmad is right. Human intelligence versus signal intelligence. Humint versus SIGINT. Left or right? Heads or tails? Where do we go? All up to me. On my shoulders. The burden of command. What now? Claire, I say. Rerun the video of Mel, but no sound, please. Her fingers move fast, and the video comes back up, and I stare at Mel's sad face, her soiled fingers, holding up today's Egyptian newspaper, her gaze nearly exhausted, her tired eyes staring out from her eyeglasses, the image grainy. An old memory pops up. After my dad died in the Gulf of Mexico, his two brothers, my uncles, decided to help Mom raise me. And usually that meant hunting trips, drinking beer while underage, and learning how to play poker. The ins and outs of dealing, betting, and most importantly, the all-vital tells. Reading your opponent. Sensing if he or she is bluffing. It all comes down to the eyes, sport. Always look to the eyes. If they're ice cold, they're not bluffing. But if they're blinking, shifting, looking down, then they got squat in their hands. The eyes. Mel's gaze, steady and even. And even with the poor quality of the video, it all becomes clear. It's not Mel, I nearly yell. That is not my daughter. Some murmurs from my crew, and I say, David, get over here. Take a look. Tell me what you see. Secret Service Agent David Stahl, who's been at Mel's side for more than 4 years, steps forward, leans over Claire, stares at the screen. I so desperately want to tell him what I see, but I need to keep my mouth shut. I need him to look without preconceptions. David steps back. Matt, you're right. That isn't Mel. The eyes. To everyone else, I say, Mel has myopia in one eye and astigmatism in the other. Due to the corrective lenses she wears, if you're looking straight on at her, one eye would appear larger than the other. I tap the screen. This girl. She looks like Mel, but it's not her. I almost feel dizzy from the range of emotions I've gone through during the past few minutes. I say, this girl's eyes are perfect. My daughter is at the other site, and we're going there as soon as we can to get her.
Chapter 111. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Mel Keating is sitting in darkness. For a little while ago, with her moistened fingers, she unscrewed the sole light bulb in her cell, leaving it in the socket. Glasses in her hand, she is forcing herself to relax, to listen, to think, and be quiet. Once, Dad said, whenever you feel trapped and helpless, take a deep, deep breath and look at everything fresh. You might be surprised at what comes into view. She tears up. Dad, I'm doing my best, honest to God, she thinks. But I'm trapped, and I'm scared, and I know what's going to happen to me tonight. For real. No more fakery. Help me, please. Something flickers against the back of her neck. Mel yells, slaps at the back of her neck, and puts her glasses back on. Spiders, bugs, scorpions? What the hell was that? She fumbles in the darkness, her hand up above her. God, suppose there's a rat up there ready to bite my fingers. And she finds the still warm bulb, twists it tight, and blessed light comes back into her cell. What the hell was on her neck? There's nothing on the floor. She looks up. Nothing seems to be flying around, but something was on her neck. She's positive about that. Mel really wants to keep standing, but forces herself to go back to where she was sitting. She sits down, both the light and her glasses on, and waits. Low talk on the other side of the door from some of Asim's men, who also use these old stables as living quarters. A bit of music. A muffled pop, pop, pop as someone fires off a rifle. Mel freezes. A slight tickle at the back of her neck. She slowly brings her hand up there, but doesn't feel a thing. But the tickle is still there. Mel quickly stands up, walks to the wall behind her, and reaches for an area up near the ceiling. She licks her fingers and holds them up against the stone and dirt and a bit of a draft, a slight breeze. Mel frantically starts digging at the stone and dirt, and a trickle of soil begins to come out. The rock here is loose, and she digs and digs. More dirt falls. The draft increases. Oh God, please, she thinks. Mel goes to the wooden shelf and takes everything off, and then works the wood free from a couple of metal stanchions. She balances the shelf on a rock and jams her good foot down, breaking it into pieces. She picks up the largest piece, with a sharp jagged edge at the end, and goes back to work. The earlier trickle of stone and dirt nearly becomes a flood. An old chimney, water stanchion, or feed trough was once there and had been sealed up. Mel slams the wood into the widening opening, again and again. The door to the room is so thick, she's sure she can't be heard. Good. She's getting the hell out of here.
Chapter 112. Svekostina Air Base, Tunisia. To our NSA rep, I say, Claire, we need anything and everything you can pull up on that site. On it, Matt, she says, and her fingers fly across the keyboard. Our little group is clustered behind her, and there are whispers, and I hold my hand up and say, shut your damn traps, Claire's working, don't disturb her. Silence. Then, as Claire whispers to herself and toggles various screens and links, and at about the same time, I realize what she's looking at. She's already moved on to something else three links down the line. Here, she says. Here is an overhead shot of a mountain terrain, boulders and narrow gorges, two flat areas separated by what looks to be a rock wall and slides. No vegetation, or vehicles, or buildings. Claire, what's the date and provenance, I ask. Sorry, Matt, she says. 10 years old, defense mapping agency, best I can do. I say, damn it, there has to be more out there than just this. Nick says, have you tried? Voice sharp, she says, you got a better idea, do you? Any of you? Anybody want to sit in front of my keyboard? Crap, I think. Sorry, Claire, I say, wanting to keep her straight and focused. You're the expert here. Everybody back away. Let her do her job. She exhales in a loud sigh of frustration, goes back to work on the keyboard, and I see lines of code, North Africa maps, global orbital elements, more lines of code. Claire says, I need a sat phone now. Nick ducks away, comes back, and gives his sat phone to her. She takes it, chews on her lower lip for a moment, and starts pressing in a series of numbers while we speak in hushed voices behind her. Guys, she says, love you all, but shut the fuck up, okay? We all shut up. The phone is apparently answered, and in a flat voice, Claire says, access. A second or two pass. She says, Bravo, Oscar, Oscar, November, Echo, 1-4-9-4. I hear a plane take off nearby. I can hear David breathing next to me. Extension 12. A few more seconds, and Claire's tone instantly changes. Hey, Josh, how's it going in Cheyenne? Missing daylight? No? Well, your complexion is so fair, you'd probably burst into flames if you went to the beach. She laughs. Nick looks to me, and I shoot him a glance to keep his stance and to keep his mouth shut. Claire says, hey, Josh, need a favor off the books? She stops. Josh, she says, Josh, come on, look. Do I have to remind you that you owe me one? Do I? You would never have gotten to the 12th level of universal conflict without me. She waits, rubbing her eyes and forehead. Josh, don't make me beg. Okay, don't. Waiting. Waiting. Mel, so damn close. So damn far away. She sits up, looks to me, smiles. Josh, perfect, you're a dear. Honest. Okay, I need a full sweep of the following location. All angles, all spectrums. Claire slowly reads off the coordinates provided to us by Ahmad bin Nayef. Then repeats them. Waits. Thanks for the readback, Josh, she says. You've got a Jason that'll be able to give us a good live view in about 10 minutes. That's all I need. Another pause. Sure, but you can get away with it, I know, she says. The damn thing still has stabilization problems. I know you've got a calibration schedule for that bird. Just do it ahead of schedule. Say this is just a test run, that's all. She laughs again. How do I know that? Do you forget where I spend my time? Okay, I'll let you get to work, and I owe you big time, really big time. Blair disconnects the sat phone, hands it back to Nick, and then bends over at the waist. Man, I feel like I'm gonna hurl. Wow. She sits back up, rubs her eyes, and says, okay, let's see what's what. On the screen, it suddenly goes black. A line of green letters and numbers appears at the top of the screen, and crisp overhead view of mountains and valleys and ridges and faint green illumination. The view slowly slides up to the top of the screen, and I get a funny feeling at the base of my skull. As president, you often get a behind-the-curtains look at what our military and intelligence systems can deliver, and this is definitely one of those times. It's like we're hovering maybe 50 or 60 feet above the ground, live, at night. Buildings, Claire says. Here we go. There's been a lot of changes from 10 years back. Alejandro whispers, God. There are 6 buildings in a semicircle, apparently stone or brick, various shapes and sizes. A flat area in front, fuzzy white shapes moving about what looks to be a stone wall to the south, and a flat stretch of mesa before it drops off. People, she says. And look, road leading up from the left, which is west. Those shapes down there. Could one be male? I squeeze my hands. Vehicles, she says. 4 trucks. Nick says, I got a head count of 12. Alejandro says, down the road, 2 guards, 1 on each side, flanking. I say, Claire, you're recording this, right? Uh-huh, she says. I look at the buildings, seeing how they seem to glow from the night vision capabilities of the overhead surveillance satellite. 6 buildings. But where is Mel? We can probably hit 1 building, maybe 2, without getting overwhelmed. But in the event of firepower and attack, does Asim have a plan to spirit Mel away or shoot her before she's rescued? Do we have time to maintain surveillance on all 6 buildings to find the one that's holding Mel? Where? What's that? I ask. Claire says, what? I lean over her, gently tap at the screen. Right there, I say, that. Claire minimizes the live broadcast and goes to a video recording. Plays it back, enlarges it, sharpens it. David says, I'll be damned. From the largest building, one that seems to have been built right into the base of a rocky peak, a faint line seems to extend out to the flat stone and dirt in the middle of the compound. And at the end of the line, going right up to the building's entrance, an arrowhead shape has been scraped away. Someone's made a straight arrow in the dirt, pointing right to the center building, like with a stick or by dragging a foot. My smart daughter. Good job, Mel. Mel's there, I say. That building. Time to get to work, people.
Part 5.
Chapter 113. The Raid on Nafusa. After an hour of briefing, planning, and more planning, we go out into the night in a quick moving line down the runway to the Tunisian Army's Black Hawk helicopter, its rotors already in motion. We're all geared up and armed, pretty similar in terms of what we're carrying, but each of us has our own little quirks and preferences in how we've prepped. When it comes to arms, I'm carrying a fully automatic Colt M4 5.56mm rifle with an infrared laser sight, and holstered at my side is a Sig Sauer 9mm P226 pistol. Extra magazines for each gun are secured in pouches. On my head is a Level 3 high-cut ballistic helmet with an ATN PVS 14 night vision device extended up into the air. I'm also wearing point-blank Level 3 body armor, and on my tactical vest I have a variety of other gear, water bottles, IFAC, individual first aid kit, quick clot combat gauze for bleeding control, spare batteries, an Ontario MOD Mark III knife, a Gerber multi-tool, and a small rucksack with a couple of other key items. Funny thing, the gear is heavy and bulky, but there's a muscle memory in putting it back on, and I don't feel burdened at all walking along this runway pavement. I feel like I can walk all night. We all have Motorola SRX 2200 single-band handheld radios, frequencies already keyed in, and Peltor Comtac headsets so we can talk to each other on the ground. Communications tonight will be easy, first names only, and our Black Hawk helicopter pilot is going by his SEAL-issued nickname of Joe, K-I-S-S. Keep it simple, stupid. Claire is carrying an extra weapon, a .308 bolt-action Remington rifle with mounted scope, since she's our sniper tonight. After a brief but heated discussion back at the maintenance shed, it turns out she's a better shot than all of us. It's 2 hours after sunset. In usual times, we would go in at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m., the best time to hit when there's a minimum of awake and alert bad guys. But this isn't a usual time. I know where Mel is. I'm taking a gamble. Going in early. Closer to the helicopter, bits of dirt and gravel are tossed our way. We're bending our heads, and I remember the last couple of hours back in our temporary quarters. Looking at the screen of Claire's laptop in hopes of determining means of entry and exit, Joe pointed to a small area to the west of the compound and said, "This wadi here. I can drop you here. It's about a click and a half away from Asim's place. It's narrow enough and 1,000 meters lower. That should mask the noise enough that you won't be noticed." I nodded and said, "Here, this flat area in front of the buildings, just beyond that low stone wall. We'll mark it with IR glow sticks when it's time to exfil. Prepare to pick us up within 45 minutes after you drop us off. We can't stay there any longer." Joe said, "Oh, I wish I had a door gunner." Nick, Alejandro, and I kept our mouths politely shut. We were all glad he didn't have a door gunner because we haven't trained with one and we don't know how good Joe's door gunner might be. It'd be a hell of a thing to get to the exfil area and be cut down by friendly fire. Nick said, "These two guard locations, Alejandro and I will leap ahead, eliminate them before the final staging." I checked my watch. It was time. David said, "Matt, just so there's no confusion, rules of engagement?" I said, "This is a rescue, nothing else. I don't care if we stumble across documents or piles of hard drives or blueprints for a dirty bomb. Mel is our sole objective. No prisoners are coming back with us, nor bodies." They all nodded in acknowledgement, and I was struck by the composition of this odd group. A Tunisian Special Forces pilot, two SEALs, an NSA field operative, a Secret Service agent, and a former POTUS. Band of strange brothers and a sister indeed. I added, "Except for Mel, there are no innocents up there. Armed or unarmed, running away or running toward us. Kill them all." As I get close to the Black Hawk helicopter, a spasm of doubt hits me just at the last moment. Am I doing the right thing? Is this really a rescue mission? Or is it an attempt by an angry and humiliated dad to get payback for what's happened to his daughter? A quick phone call by me, Nick, or Alejandro to JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, telling them where Mel is located, would get the professionals up and running. But that's the key point, up and running. Unlike what some History Channel programs might have viewers believe, Special Forces aren't stored somewhere, gear up and ready, straining against the leash, ready to head out at a moment's notice. No, there would have to be activation, planning, preparation, phone calls up the chain of command, maybe, just maybe, as the sun rises tomorrow, a unit might be on its way to the Nafusa Mountains. Too late. One by one, we climb up into the helicopter, take our positions along the canvas seats. Overhead is a dangling headset with a mic. And I take my helmet off, put the headset on, and say, "Joe, Matt here. We're all on board." "Thanks, Matt," he says. And the helicopter's crew chief slides the door shut, gives us a smile and a thumbs up, and we wait. And wait. And wait. "Joe, what's going on?" I ask over the intercom. "Mr. President, a slight problem," he says. "What is it?" A little hiss of static. "It seems the tower isn't satisfied that this is an unannounced night training flight, and the colonel is racing over here right now to stop us." Nick Zeppos is the only other one here who's wearing the Black Hawk's comm gear, and he catches my eye, looks concerned. I say, "Joe, what are you planning?" He chuckles. "I'm planning a communications problem, that's all." The pitch and sound of the Black Hawk's engines increase, and there's a slight sway as we take off and head out into the night to the east. Mel, I think. Just a few more minutes. Just a few more minutes.
Chapter 114. Mel Keating takes a quick break, eyes her progress. By working with the jagged piece of wooden shelving, she has widened the hole so that she can put her head and shoulders up into it, but her hands are blistered and cut. So what? Mel takes a long swallow of warm bottled water and then stands on the pile of dirt and rock so she can work with the wood up higher. Shove, shove, shove. Scrape, scrape, scrape. Rocks and dirt and bits of stone shower down, getting into her hair and mouth, and she keeps on frantically digging. Scrape, shove. Mel waits. What's that? Voices from beyond the door. Mel's breathing quickens. If the door is unlocked and someone comes in, what can she say? That she was suddenly struck by inspiration from Mom's career and decided to start an archaeological dig in the last hours of her life? No, Mel thinks, stepping off the fresh dirt and rock pile and going to the door. If the door opens, she's going to take this piece of jagged wood and shove it into the throat of the first guy to come through. No begging, no crying. Going out like a badass. She waits. No more voices. The faint sound of music being played on a radio. All right then, Mel whispers. Back to the dirt pile. Shove, scrape, shove. The piece of wood slides up unexpectedly, and a burst of cold air comes down and caresses her dirty and sweaty face. She's broken free to the outside. Mel coughs, wipes her face, and quickly goes back to work. So close. So very, very close. More rocks and dirt trickle out and tumble down. She pushes up and falls. Her right ankle screams at her, and the pain just radiates up her leg and spine. Mel rolls over, clenches her fist, tries to take deep breaths. Get up, she thinks. Get up. You're the daughter of two tough and determined parents. Prove it. Mel gets up, hopping on her good foot, gets the piece of wood, and starts hammering away again. Nothing is going to stop her now. Nothing.
Chapter 115. The first nearly 100 miles of our journey goes over flat water, the famed Gulf of Sidra, and Joe quietly says over the intercom, "Feet dry, Mr. President. We're in Libyan airspace now." "Copy that, Joe," I say, and look to my fellow warriors inside the Black Hawk. As with so many other missions I've been on, each person here is in his or her own world. There's no rah-rah, no speeches, no words of daring do. We all sit quietly, a couple of us drinking from water bottles, others just staring out or trying to sleep. The steady roar of the engines, the red-lit interior, the straps and webbing and gear, it's all so familiar to me. I've been inside Blackhawks like this countless times, either on training missions or real ops, and it's like being with an old friend, say for one thing. This isn't an official operation or a training exercise. It's the real deal. We're out to rescue my daughter. And while failure in training or in a real-life op can be expected or even excused, not tonight. No failure. It cannot happen. I will not allow it. We speed along into the night, above the rocky desert and landscape of nighttime Libya. My earphones crackle. 2 minutes, Mr. President, Joe says. 2 minutes. Copy that, I say. I take off the headset, rearrange my Peltor Comtech headset, and hold up two fingers to the rest of my crew. 2 minutes, I call out. 2 minutes. We put on our respective helmets, lower the night vision gear, switch it on. Instantly, everything inside the helicopter has a ghostly green glow. I yell out, "Move tight, move quick, let's get this done." The Black Hawk's angle of approach and speed change, and the crew chief for the Black Hawk joins us, toggles free the near sliding door, pushes it open. Cold night air rushes in, and the ground is coming up close, rock walls dangerously near, and then we lift up and go down, and there's the narrow wadi that Joe picked out earlier, and the helicopter speed changes again. We lower, lower, hover. Off we go, one by one. Nick Zeppos is the last one off, and we huddle, our heads lowered, as the Black Hawk zooms up and out, and we're alone. I stand up. Comm check, I say. Matt's here. Claire. Nick. Alejandro. David, says the last voice. All coming in loud and clear, I say, scanning in all directions, checking out the overhead rocks and flat cliffs. Nothing, I say. Nick and Alejandro, you're up. We'll be following in 10 minutes. Copy that, Nick says. Copy that, Alejandro says. They move up the rocks like young mountain goats, skipping up and ahead, and the tightness in my chest eases some. We came in cold, no shots, no mortar rounds falling, nothing. The sound of the Black Hawk is a distant humming noise. There's no moon tonight, but the sky is so clear and cold that even the starlight is giving us pretty good visibility, even without our NVGs. I check my watch, and it's glowing numerals. 10 minutes have passed. Saddle up, folks, I say, and we start climbing. After another 15 minutes of climbing and hiking, pausing every few minutes to check our surroundings, we get to the narrow dirt road leading up steeply to Asim Alashid's compound. We all take a knee under cover of nearby rocks and boulders. I give the area a slow 360-degree observation. All quiet. All lifeless. The M4, with safety off and around in its chamber, is firm in my gloved hands. My headset remains quiet. Up the road, Nick and Alejandro are on the job, and I know enough not to bother them. I look up the steep and narrow road. A couple of days ago, Mel traveled up here, saw these very rock walls, breathed this same mountain air. So damn close. My earphones come to life. Matt, this is Nick. Nick, go, I say. Matt, we're good here, waiting on Alejandro. And that is that. One man or teen boy, dreaming of glory and jihad and heaven, sitting in the cold dirt working his shift as a guard for one of the most wanted terrorists in the world, quietly got a sound-suppressed 5.56mm round between his eyes. Copy that, Nick, I whisper. Good job. Next up, Alejandro. We wait. Nothing moves. Nothing calls out in the dark night. Just everything bathed in green ghost light. I wait. I check my watch. Slow minutes pass. Nick, this is Matt, I say. Status? Matt, this is Nick, he replies. Waiting on Alejandro. Aren't we all? Waiting. I shift my weight, impatience starting to gnaw at me. Let him do his job, I think. But so many things could have gone wrong in the short time since we've landed. Alejandro being ambushed, or stumbling and falling into a crevasse. We're not finding the guard who's moved his position, who might be seeing us now, reporting back to Asim via his handheld radio that an armed party is coming his way. I toggle my transmit switch. Alejandro, I whisper. This is Matt. Status? No reply. Again. Alejandro, this is Matt. Status? Nothing. I feel like it's all slipping away.
Chapter 116. Jiang Lijun looks up as the door is unlocked and Faraj enters, holding a small flashlight in his right hand. It's time, Faraj says, coming to him, kneeling down to undo the locks holding Jiang's chains to the chair. Jiang asks, why so late? Faraj says, Asim had to wait for his meal, and then he wanted some private time with his driver, Tarak. He's planning on packing up everyone and leaving later tonight after he finishes his task. Jiang rubs at his hands and ankles, stands up. What task? Faraj steps back, drops the chains and locks on the dirt floor. He wants you to witness him killing Mel Keating, so you can go back to Beijing and tell your masters that you've met a true man of God, who cannot be bribed or tempted by the riches of this life. Then he plans to use a body double in the years ahead, releasing a videotape here and there to torment Matt Keating that his daughter is still alive. At some point, decades from now, after years of Keating's mental anguish, my cousin plans to tell the truth and reveal the location of Mel Keating's bones, his final means of revenge. Jiang steps up. But you cannot allow that. Faraj gestures with the flashlight. I won't. Come along. I'll take care of my cousin, and then we'll get Mel Keating. Jiang thinks quickly. My pistol. Return it to me, please. Faraj shakes his head.
Be thankful we let you keep your protective vest. That's all you'll need. Jiang follows Faraj out to the darkness of the compound. Happy that, yes, he is keeping his protective vest, and also knowing that hidden away in the vest are a few items that will prove useful in the next few minutes. Thankfully, these brave and stupid warriors didn't take the time to closely search him when he was captured. Still, he thinks, he wishes he had his QSZ-92 9mm pistol at his side. But he will go ahead. In planning, wishes don't count. It takes just a few minutes to come to a large building in the center of the compound. It's a starlit night, and there are two flickering fires and old oil drums, and Jiang shakes his head at the carelessness of Asim's fighters. No discipline at all. Ahead, Asim calls out,
"Ah, cousin. Glad to see our Chinese friend is with us. Please, come along. What a historic night."
Asim is in front of a heavy wooden door, and Jiang again takes in the cold mountain air. A lovely night to do what must be done, and, most of all, to live. Jiang allows himself the hope that he will live out the night, and he decides to try once more, no matter what Faraj has offered. He says,
"Asim, I am again pleased to see you. And again, I have to ask, will you let the girl free in my custody? And no payment will be made nor offered. Then I will return to my superiors in Beijing and tell them of you, not only a man of God, but also a man of mercy."
In the dim light, Jiang sees Asim's face widen into a smile, and he mentions something to one of the two men guarding the entrance, and a laugh is shared. Jiang thinks, well, it was worth the effort. Asim says,
"A good try, but don't be afraid, Jiang. You will survive tonight. I give you my vow. You and the West, sometimes you forget the importance of God, of vows, of self-discipline. Like my dear cousin Faraj."
Faraj looks concerned, and Jiang takes one careful step back. Asim goes on,
"Faraj is loyal, smart, and a good fighter to have at your side. But he is always tempted by the technologies, like drones or battery-operated coolers for forbidden drinks or listening devices."
He quickly steps next to Faraj, flings an arm across his shoulder.
"Even if you don't need any of these technologies, like when a good man with good ears listening through an open window can tell you all you need to know."
Faraj moves quickly, but Asim is faster, pulling a knife from underneath his vest and plunging it into his cousin's chest.
Chapter 117. And then, like a voice from above, Alejandro comes through. "Matt, this is Alejandro," he says. "Alejandro, this is Matt. Go," he says calmly. "Sorry for the delay, Matt. My guy left his post, went to water a rock. I took him out midstream." Sweet relief courses through me. I say, "Nick, Alejandro, proceed. We'll meet you at the jump-off points." We three stand up as one and resume our pace, the only sound being the gentle crunch, crunch of our booted feet on the dirt road as we climb. We don't hurry, but we don't move slowly either, just methodical and on point, our heads swiveling around, always looking, seeing, evaluating. The road widens. Rocks and boulders are clustered at either side. The land flattens out. We move to the right, going in and around the rocks and scree. I hold up a hand. We pause. Voices. We move slower, spreading out. I look through a gap of rocks, see the buildings come into view. Two oil drums burning, armed men moving around in small groups of two or three. Laughter. A flapping sound as the large tarpaulin covering four pickup trucks moves in the breeze. I quietly join Nick and Alejandro there as David and Claire keep moving and go behind the low stone wall, heading to the front of the center building. That building, close up against the rise of rocks, is now in clear view. Mel is in there, I think. My daughter is there, right there. Just a few seconds more. All that's gone on during the past few weeks, from her kidnapping to the murder of her boyfriend Tim, to the dark horror of that beheading video, and the hopeful hints that she was still alive to my own journey here. All of those memories and thoughts roar through me as I rest on this cold, stony ground in Libya. Now, less than 50 meters away, my daughter waits. I check my watch. Almost time.
Chapter 118. Mel Keating bends over in her cell, coughing and choking after a big burst of dirt slams into her mouth and nose. She stands up, grabs her last bottle of water, takes a swallow. Close. Mel caps the water bottle, puts the bottle under her shirt, starts working her way up the hole. Head through, shoulders, squirm, elbows to the side, digging in, digging in. She stops, plugged. Damn it! She worms her way back down, nearly losing her glasses in the process. Damn it again! And she's back on the floor, breathing hard. Picks up the length of wood. Digs some more. More rocks tumble down. There. Should be enough. Has to be enough. Mel goes back, stands on the little mound of dirt. Voices getting louder and getting closer. She looks up the hole and convinces herself she sees the night sky and stars up there. Freedom. Someone starts unlocking the door. Out of time.